Welcome to Game On with Grace, where we're not just talking cricket wins and losses, we're talking off-field antics, guilty pleasures, and the drive that never quits. Hey everyone, I'm Grace Hayden, and today's episode is a very special one. My guest is one of the most dominant opening batters the game has ever seen. A World Cup winner, a record breaker, and a cornerstone of Australian cricket's golden era. But for me, he's also just that. That's right, today I'm talking to Matthew Hayden. From powering his way to 380 in Test cricket to redefining what fearless batting looks like, he built a career on strength, resilience, and an unshakable belief in his game. Now we're sharing the mic together, from living room to global stage, including the past T20 World Cup that we just saw. So today, we're going beyond the stats and into the stories. The competitor, the teammate, the father, and maybe a few things I haven't heard before. Game on. Hey, Dad. Welcome to Game On with Grace. So happy to have you on here. Who would have thought, hey? Joining the podcast.
Game on, all right, Grace. I hope you've got your best foot forward because I'm coming at you.
Oh, here we go. Look out. Look
all
out.
Your tell me where nasty are you? Little How secrets. Are you? All the things are just going to come out right now.
Oh, good. How joyous. No, it's all about you today. All about you. The one time I'm going to allow you to talk about yourself, all right?
Okay. All right. I suppose you're the boss. I'm not convinced that's the case, but
you're in the hot seat today.
We'll play that game anyway.
Perfect. All right. Well, tell me, how are you? Where are you? Where in the world are you right now?
Yeah. I'm in Ahmedabad, which is obviously in the not very far west coast, but west coast above Mumbai, so above Maharashtra. IPL season number 19. Gosh, feeling old, considering just, you know, when you go back to the start of the IPL, you know, that was at the end of my career, really. So anyway, got more of that to come. But yes, I'm in Ahmedabad. I'm batting coach for the Gujarat Titans. Obviously, I've got an extremely talented batting team. I'm not sure exactly how much influence I can have on a Joss Butler, 35-year-old gun that's, you know, made 100 IPL 50s. You know, he's a crazy good player. So, yeah, we're in good shape and I'm loving it. It's good.
Yeah, and I mean, you've seen it literally from the get-go, from conception to then now, but in so many different facets of the game as well. You've been a player, you've been a commentator, now you've also stepping into a coaching role too. Tell me, what is it like? How much have you seen it change over the years? As you just said, the 19th IPL season, that's crazy, 19 years. Well, I guess since your retirement, you want to say too, but, you know, 19 years of this unbelievable tournament, which is really, I think, redefined cricket.
Yeah, definitely. When you look at historically where the game has come from, the first big revolution was Kerry Packer and his revolution around ODI cricket and taking on not only Cricket Australia's board, but then taking on the rest of the global game in a very unique way to create a product which was a little more digestible for mainstream cricket. So that certainly took the game to its first, if you like, birdie of par five, because you're playing the long game in cricket. I mean, even T20 cricket, it's 4 hours. That's a long game. But certainly that sort of marked through the 70s, you know, the great revolution of white ball cricket, the best players in the world congregating around World Series cricket in Australia, the protests against the board and how that kind of manifested itself in legal battles, financial claims, split of playing group, because for the first time players, they didn't have just one pathway, they had two pathways. And that was tough for a lot of Australian cricketers, and it was tough for the respective boards of the West Indies. You know, you think back to those times and you had, you know, incredible players like Sir Clive Lloyd, Viv Richards, who was, you know, a personal hero of mine. Who didn't want to be Viv Richards, let's face it. I mean, the swagger of him, man. Can you imagine him in the modern game, just to plant that question? But then, you know, you think about how that then challenged other really traditional boards. In fact, the founders of cricket in the ECB, a lot of those guys coming out and playing just meant that the game was rocked and shaken like a good cocktail. It was really put together and it was fantastic. And then you sort of put your mind forward to 2007, and granted that there was a lot of other boards that were playing T20 cricket at this time, but the superpower wasn't really interested. It was on a very traditional route. It was a sleeping giant, to say the least, because when we lost our game to India in the World Cup in 2007 in Durban, my mate Srisant just nipping on back and bowling me. You know, it was one of those moments which at the time I was obviously as an athlete just completely frustrated about. But retrospectively and in hindsight, had Australia gone to win that game and India not go on to play the semis and the finals in that T20 World Cup in South Africa, and you just think, where would the game really have gone? Because out of that was the rebirth of T20 cricket in India. And, you know, Lalit Modi was the brainchild. He was the disruptor. He was the disturber. He was the influencer. He was almost, in many respects, the anti-authority to BCCI. And here we are, you know, because of that strategy, bold as it may, private investment, which is a big challenge to itself because, I mean, boards operate on a not-for-profit position. And so, you know, you've got private investors now, and it's just extraordinary to see how those, you know, two institutions, non-financial and financial, merging. And there was a great sense of a journey. I think players were certainly ready to go on the journey. Andrew Simons was the first million-dollar man in the IPL. And you've got, at that time, the season franchises, eight being delivered to market, zero idea of how it was going to rock and roll, other than there was this air of, this is what's next. You know, we've had the revolution of one-day cricket, T20 cricket is kind of where it's at. And you know, what blessed, you know, when you think back to it, yes, I was one of the first players in the tournament in the inaugural year. And now here I am coaching in its 19th year, and everything in between that we can discuss has been such an incredible part of my life, my career, my family's life. I mean, I owe a lot to India and in particular to the IPL.
Talk to me about your personal journey within the IPL, though. I mean, as I mentioned before, you've been a player, you've been a commentator, now a coach. How do they compare to each other? What do you love about being so ingrained in this tournament now?
Yeah, Grace, it's hard to compartmentalize, but they are very different careers. You know, playing the focus is on high performance only. I mean, you are looking for a tenth of a percent. Forget the 1%ers. You're just looking for an edge. And I kind of felt that was covered. You know, when I first started playing, I was at the back end of my career. In 2009, I finished playing my international playing career for Australia. We'd won multiple World Cups, every trophy on the planet, really. And consistently, I was a part of such an incredibly talented team, you know, a really iconic era of cricket. In fact, probably three decades of iconic cricket. So the fight and struggle for that was something which held me in great stead for what was to come, because you not only had to be the best player in the world to get into that Australian side, because they were all world beaters. But you had to just be so damn sharp within your own game to even get a gig. So it was really challenging playing for Australia. Make no bones about it. You're always on notice. I mean, your mum and I would talk often about the next tour very reluctantly because it wasn't a certainty. You know, there wasn't that kind of position where you could get comfortable. In fact, you had to be the absolute polar opposite. You had to be super uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. that was a really important part of my journey as a player. So when we reached the IPL in 2008, the uncertainty led to certainty pretty quickly because my captain was MS Dhoni, and he represented a place that I was really comfortable with, and that was Tamil Nadu and Chennai. And those first 3 years, they were formidable years. You know, they were full of wonderful memories, close calls, and then winning the title in 2010, Chennai's first, was just phenomenal. Then going on to win the Champions League as well in South Africa. So, yeah, lots of fond memories, Chuck.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you got a favourite memory?
One that really stands out just because of the colossal moment was the 2010 final against Mumbai Indians. Now, we grew up in Queensland, and, you know, this time of year, mid-year, you start to get the quakes around the state of origin and the rivalry that exists amongst Queensland and New South Wales. And it's a very similar rivalry between Chennai and Mumbai. You know, the Mumbai Indians are a formidable force in this IPL. They're equal holders of titles to CSK. They make their home grounds fortresses. They always have an incredible list of young Indian batters and bowlers. You know, they fill their sides up full of the very best domestic talent. And they just go to war together. You know, so in 2010, where famously MS Dhoni had me in this like weird position, it was almost straight behind the bowler in the final, and Coram Pollard is the only man left standing between us and the victory, because that boy, as you know, is just a coliseum. And he hits long balls, and in particular, long balls in big games. So when the ball was delivered and it was smacked down to me, and I took a tidy catch. It wasn't going to feature on any kind of classic catches of the IPL, but it was certainly an important catch. And to me, that was, you know, my favourite memory. When we got him out, it was just inevitable that CSK were going to win that first title. And so it was that we did. It was great.
Oh, what a memory. Tell me, how are you enjoying this new role as a coach, batting coach for Gujarat Titans? You know, you've played, you've commentated, but now you're coaching. How different is it? Are you liking being involved in the game in this capacity? What's it been like?
Yeah, love it. Really pleased that I've taken the chance to get back involved in high performance. I felt like when I'm broadcasting, I was watching the game as a third person, and that third person was not quite understanding what are the actual conversations. Why are they taking risky options around this particular matchup, and not really having the kind of the solid answer to that? And I suppose it's just a generational thing. I'm sure that when Ian Chappell was broadcasting on my career, and he couldn't understand why I was such a front dogger, you know, going forward at the ball. You know, he was very much a back and a cross, and quite an orthodox and conservative player, good cutter and puller, whereas I didn't have a cut shot. And I'm pretty sure he would have been going, well, he doesn't have a cut shot, so how can he exist? So for me, you know, just getting close to the game again, and a game obviously which I know and love, but then getting on the inside of conversations, because the gap I still feel, it was the same in my generation, the gap is what's happening between your left and right ear. And how is it that just game awareness and instinct and mindset can become a lethal weapon when it comes to a game of cricket? Like, how do you, for example, take on Jasprit Bumrah? Are you a Sandy Constance in front of 100,000 people playing reverse slogs in a test match? See, that's the stuff that I love to dig into, because I always feel like your weapon is your awareness around the game as a player. This is.
Yeah.
Like, I remember a time I was struggling and Alan Border came up to me and said, "Mate, you're not watching the ball." Now, who's going to argue with Alan Border? But the truth is that I wasn't watching the ball. I was focused on maybe a certain, my own stuff, you know, a certain, maybe my step out to a bowler or the focus around another bowler that I wanted to attack too hard. You know, these pieces of advice, they come to you at different times in your career, and that's the stuff that I'm really looking forward to digging into. And not just to the superstar players like Josh. You know, he's his own beast, and what a wonderful career he's having. As I mentioned before, you know, like 150s in a tournament. That's a pretty extraordinary number, right?
Unbelievable statistic. I mean, crazy.
Crazy. But then there's other youngsters that are coming up that you just, you know, you've got this potential to unleash, you know,
beast.
The kind of advice and develop an ecosystem of trust and building upon, you know, what looks like going to be a fabulous career. Someone like Kushara, for example, who played in instead of our captain Shubby. In the second game, I think it was. It just, you know, he's a kid that's just such a beautiful technical player. You know, hard to give him advice on his technique, right hand, upright player. But again, just so looking forward to unlocking his potential as you know, one of the next generation really good players of Indian cricket, of which, you know, the list is long. There's so much. It's a bountiful ecosystem when it comes to, you know, batting. But there is opportunity for technical players to play even the short versions of the game, and how we unlock their potential is the exciting part as a coach.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's an exciting journey ahead. I'm keen for you, Dad. I get nervous every time the Gujarat Titans play, especially when they're batting. So you've caused
you
a lot
invested,
of stress
to
me. Oh, so invested. It's bad. And my team is CSK, but this IPL, I feel somewhat obliged that Gujarat Titans have to go well as well.
Yeah, CSK is obviously, you know, very special to us as a family. I mean, even just recently, you know, being inducted into their Hall of Fame with Suresh Raina, that was an amazing experience. I mean, it, just to sort of paint the picture of that, this was a kind of semi launch of IPL season 19 for them. They had A.R. Rahman, who, you know, as we know, is a beautiful musical director. Slumdog Millionaire will always live in our hearts. There's no doubt about it. But then we were just sort of had a random sort of little game in the middle. It was a full house. Full house.
Yeah.
At Chufuck Stadium.
Crazy. The energy. Everyone was just loving it. They got you batting again.
Yeah. Yeah, can you believe it? Yeah, had to dust off the L4 and L5.
Yeah,
to start swinging away. but yeah, no, that the place is very special, obviously, and you know we've got a real heart in the Yellow Army, but you know, so too we've got a great family over here in Gujarat as well that play like a family, and it's a village, it's a cricketing village, the IPL ecosystem. And long may it continue, because it makes the whole place a lot more enjoyable, a lot more relaxed, a lot more kind of in the moment. It's not, you know, it's not missing and, you know, thinking about what they could be doing in another environment. It's just they're purely here, and it's really good.
Well, that's the ins and outs of the IPL from a man who's seen it as a player, a commentator, and now a coach. But we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to hear more about the man himself, Matthew Hayden. All right, well, I want to move into the section of the podcast. It's called Human Behind the Hype. It's where I get to know you and the audience gets to know you, you know, outside of the accolades and the big achievements. So what I want to ask you first up, Dad, is where cricket started for you? Where did the love start? Tell us the journey where you fell in love with this great game.
Sitting on a Massey Ferguson tractor at 2 o'clock in the morning, and listening to Henry Blofield talk about Jeff Boycott in an Ashes series. And then my brother and I, Uncle Gary, Gary and I would go up to our net, and which Dad hand cut with one of the big tractors. He put a grader through our 10-acre house block, and we converted that into a cricket wicket, put nets around it. Built those ourselves. Used to go out every afternoon with this little tennis roller, the same ones that used to crush the ant bed tennis courts with, and push that for an hour and then pad up. And then the next minute, Mum would be calling us for dinner because it was too dark and we had to do our homework. And it was our game. It wasn't anyone else's game. So it was a very unique take on the game because I guess I didn't have any rules. I couldn't see necessarily how Ian Chappell wanted me to play because I didn't see a lot of him play. You know, so my own style was developed from just playing the game. And even when I think back at it, and I'd love to one day go into this a bit more about how players evolve, because I know for me that we used to have this swimming pool, and it had a pool room, which you know about. And the pool room has got glass on one side and it's a brick walls on the other with little windows on one side. But Mum always used to get dirty with us playing into the glass. And as a left-hander, that was my cut shot. So I didn't really want to smack it into the glass because I didn't want to annoy Mum. And plus, I didn't want to break the glass. I mean, it's obvious, right? I didn't want to smack it so hard into the glass. So I used to play to the onside a lot because that was all brick wall and it was a bigger gap as well. So the one hand, one bounce rule, where I didn't want Gary swooping in and getting me out. I didn't ever want to get out. Simple as that. And even when I think back to it, take your own view, Chook, on the back wall, and there was boxes, there was lines for wides, for the wides. There was stumps drawn on the bricks as well. So it's almost like that was the now Hawkeye. So we would have our own umpire's call, if you like, on what was a wide and what's not, because that anything that we could have to stop arguments was a good thing. So our game and my game developed around just our own play, and I think that's kind of is the same with everyone. I don't think that's a unique situation, but certainly growing up in regional Australia, not watching the game, just playing our own game, was where I first loved the game.
Give us insight in what young Matty Hayden was like. What did you love? I know that for a fact that you have said to me multiple times you didn't want to go to boarding school in Brisbane. You would have just loved to stay on the farm and be a farmer. But, you know, That's the journey that you had to go on. Grade 11 and 12, you were sent to boarding school. But give us that schooling journey for you, and how much that changed your route in life.
Well, firstly, our family is rooted in education. So a lot of Mum's side of the family have letters in music, and Mum herself has got letters in music and speech and drama. Boarding school, I didn't like at all. I found it really challenging, not to mention the competitive side of it. You had to fight to get a glass of milk, for God's sake, let alone, you know, anything else. So in many ways, it was the kind of making of me, because it really hardened me up really quickly. And it gave me an introduction to first grade cricket in Brisbane, playing for Valleys District Cricket Club, which was a one iron away from Marist College Ashgrove, my school. There was a whole world of brotherhood, which I just leant right into. I mean, Alan Border was our captain, Stuart Law, Michael Ephraims. There was Jeff Foley. There were so many guys there that were just, they were really great seasoned international or national cricketers. And I just learned a bunch so quickly. And because I had that kind of fight, and this is something that I've always had my entire life, just because my brother's 5 years older for a start. So I was always fighting, not literally fighting, but in a cricket sense, just always fighting to be competitive. And so when I arrived at Valleys, it just felt like I was home in many respects. And I stayed with Valleys Cricket Club my entire career. I played over 100 games of first grade cricket, which I think people forget about. They forget about the fact that what they see is all the bright lights. You know, they see the 103 test matches. They see the 30-odd hundreds. They just, that's what they get. And it's no fault. It's just that's where they consume the game. But no one really recognises or cares, frankly, about the shadows of our sport. And our shadows of our sport are domestic and pathways cricket, where there may be no one watching, but there you are still doing all the hard work, you know, learning about the game, mostly learning about failure, because you are going to fail a lot more than what you succeed in the game of cricket. That is your lot if you choose to be a cricketer. And so getting the momentum through great mentor programs, you know, great leadership from individuals that I've just mentioned, that allowed you to stretch and break and mend and improve, and, you know, all of those factors I feel very grateful for. And I know that we had a very simple pathways. In other words, we played grade cricket, we played state cricket, we played Australian cricket, if we were all lucky enough to do those three layers. But now we didn't have a choice like the modern day players. So I really hope that, you know, if you're a Pat Cummins, you understand the importance that those different levels of the game have created for you, and to never forget about giving back to it. Because, you know, having multiple employers now, I mean, if you're Pat, for example, you could play for the Seattle side, you could, you know, you come back and play for Hyderabad, you Big Bash League. Yeah, these are all
you can play 365 days a year. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, 2 or 3 days a year playing grade cricket, you know, meant so much to a young Sammy Constance, you know, for example, who's just evolving in the game, is going to be a great player. There's just no doubt about it in my head. With the right mentoring and the right approach, he's just one of those, it could be a legacy player. But it takes the influence, as they say, it takes a village to raise a child. It's the same in cricket. It's a village mentality to make the game prosper. And in particular in Australian cricket, where it needs its superstars to continue to give back to the game and to find a way to give back to the game as well.
You had a really interesting journey in between, you know, progressing through the ranks of, as what you've just mentioned now, to then when you actually finally made it. What was your I made it moment, and how hard was it to actually get to that point?
It didn't happen on a playing field, my I made it moment. Can you believe it? It actually happened with your mum at North Stradbroke Island. It was ahead of 2001 Border Gavaskar Trophy in India. And we just finished a grueling sandhill run session. So for those that don't know, sandhills, They're just hard work. I mean, your feet sink into the sand. That they've got extreme elevation. It must be 70 degree elevation. And when you start running them, you've got nothing but lactic acid just dissolving your muscles until you sort of feel like you're coughing up blood. That's what you definitely feel like vomiting. But I got to the end of that session, and I trained, and Mum did as well. We just trained really hard, and we just seemed to be fighting to survive in the game. And I'll never forget, I turned to her and I said, look, this 2001 India series, I'm ready. I've been preparing since 94, 95, when I came across to that MRF Academy spin bowling clinic that I was talking about before. And I'd evolved that into captaining North Hants for 2 years with three wonderful young spinners, Monty Panesar and Alex Brown and Graham Swan, on spinning tracks. I'd had another season with Hampshire, which I absolutely loved, under the late, great Rob Smith, and just really enjoyed our time, you know, in county cricket. I'd done the 1,000 hours, the 3,000 hours that it had taken. I'd paid the price to cross the river over into being a very fine test cricketer. And I turned to Mum and I said, I am tired of improving. I am tired of making excuses as well around how it is that I'm going to move forward in the game. So I promised her right there and then that I was just going to be me. I didn't want to have another second where I was wanting to be Alan Border, or I was wanting to be Mark Taylor or Mark Waugh or Steve Waugh or any of these great players that I was playing alongside of. Who wouldn't want to be like David Boone, a gutsy little tenacious right-hand batter that just gave his heart and soul to his country? That was what epitomized the baggy green. But I had to make it my baggy green, you know, and until that time I hadn't. I'd played 15 test matches, you know, I'd averaged 20. In spite of having this body of work behind me, 100 games for Valleys, averaging almost 60. 100 games for Queensland, averaging almost 60. You know, 50-odd, 60-odd average in county cricket, season after season, 1,000 runs, seasons, just bedrock of body of work. And yet I brought all of that and averaged 20 in test cricket. And it was just, why? Why was I trying to be something else other than what I was? And that was an aggressive left-hand opening batter that took on bowlers. That at that point, that was the phase I was in. I was feared. They knew it. I knew it. But at international level, they didn't know it yet. So to catch India by surprise was one of the great treats for me personally in 2001. To catch, you know, the great bowler of Harbhajan Singh, thinking that, who was this bloke? And he can't play a sweep shot. Well, yeah, I can, mate. and I'm playing it right now in Mumbai against you on an absolute dust bowl turner. And the irony of all this is that India was that place. India was that place where it allowed me to just be me. And it still does. It doesn't judge. It appreciates, it admires, it respects, and allows me to feel this great freedom, whether it's my own attitude or perception, I don't know, but it is a place where I feel very grounded always, in spite of having to fight for life sometimes here. It can be quite difficult. You know, the long hours traveling in cars and the 4 o'clock in the morning get-ups and the 430 selfies before you actually get on the flight and... but there is such great momentum. So that's my moment of arrival. And no doubt India has played a huge role in that acceptance of who I am as a person.
And then you went on, obviously, to have an incredible career once you did finally reach that moment. When you finally earned that spot in the Aussie side, Dad, You know, you mentioned that you always had that fighting spirit, and you finally stopped fighting not being who you were and actually fronting up and being, I am Matthew Hayden, and this is how I'm going to start playing. How did you actually act on that? What was the action? Because it's all great to say it, but what was the action into implementing that into the way that you played?
Yeah, well, this is where it becomes a very special and dynamic relationship with the game. So squaring away your own stuff is an important part of cricket because, after all, it is an individual game. You have certain prerequisites in order to be in a privileged position like I was in the Australian cricket team. So I came in at the Allan Border era, didn't make it. AB, and probably one of the famous pieces of memorabilia, of which we have very few up around our house, but it's actually in Granddad and Grandma's house, is a hand painting of Allan Border. And he goes and said on the inscription, "Haydos, nothing worthwhile in life comes easily. AB." Bang. Then I went into the Mark Taylor regime, which Mark Taylor is one of the great captains of all time in Australian cricket history. And he's a left-hand opening batsman. I didn't have a place. And I know why I didn't have a place, because I wasn't good enough. Mark was. Now I come into the Steve Waugh regime. Steve Waugh took and trusted that I was his next opening batsman. He would communicate regularly the fact, and he loved the way that I had a great sense of competitive spirit and fight. And so when he became captain, I got my third rebirth into the Australian cricket team. And that's where it's not about me now, because I'm there. It's my time. What it's about is my brothers and how damn good their individual performances are, and actually how similar their stories and journeys were. So, yeah, I think in answer to your question, coming back into that side in 99 for the first time, I took Greg Blewett's spot. As you know, Greg and I do a podcast together. We're great mates. We have no animosity amongst each other, because he too played great test match cricket, but it was time for me to come through the ranks. Just as simple as that. I'd waited long enough. Him and Matty Elliott, please step aside, because it's my time. And so they pushed me, because they kept on getting 1,000-run years as well. They were such good players. So I have to thank many people, but most of all those that I was doing battle with in the shadows. By the time it actually came to the competition themselves, there was no side that we felt we were going to lose to. It was just crazy. It was crazy, you know, just that era of cricket. I can imagine it would have been very similar to what we're going to feel now in the white ball game in India.
Mm.
I feel like, yeah, India are going to dominate the white ball game for the next decade, because the line of batters, and I've got two greats in this side, Sai Sudarshan and Shubman Gill, who will have to be in the battle of their lives against a Suryavanshi who's 15. You know, it just blows your mind away. You know, that
the internal fight.
The internal fight is crazy.
And do you really think that that's what made the golden era what it was? The internal fight, the plethora of talent, the fact that your spot could be taken literally in a second because there's someone else that is as good, if not better.
Yeah, struggle's good. I just feel that if you, and I mentioned this before, if you're not prepared to be really comfortable being uncomfortable, I think I said it wrong the first time. I think I said uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. It's comfortable with being uncomfortable. Like to be on edge, but then to find a peace that allows you then just to be able to let go and perform is kind of the golden triangle of success in my book. Peace, letting go, performance. It's just, they just all work in a magic clockwork. And they all come to you in very different ways. mean, I look at the way that players, you know, prepare now, and there's remarkable similarities. Like Sai Sudarshan, for example, it's unreal how he goes to the game the day before, just exactly like I did for 20 years of my career. Doesn't hit a ball, just sits in the middle, sees the game, visualizes exactly what he has to do, and plays the game in his head. I feel that that's such an important part of how it is that you can be a great international player. To see what you want to achieve in life is as important as is actually achieving it. And I always say, be careful what you think about in life, because it's often so quick that it manifests itself in whatever ways, good and bad. You know, bad thoughts, bad actions, bad consequences. Good thoughts, good actions, good consequences.
I want to talk quickly about family because I know how important it is. Mum and you have been married for
30 years this year.
30 years.
Yeah. 30 years.
I was
going to say
29. Yeah. 30.
Yep. 30 years.
Crazy.
Yep. Yeah.
How important was she in shaping who you are?
Well, extreme. It's hard to put this part of my life into words. Like you all, is that, you know, 30 years and I look at our, if you do a sheet on what success looks like, three beautiful kids, you know, an amazing career, amazing family that we've been able to support and guide and cherish and nurture. And not to mention, I guess, on top of that is the importance of a career. That's not an easy thing to do. As we just mentioned, it's quite uncomfortable, long periods apart. And in many ways, it actually, you know, we weren't together as much, Mum and I, because she was looking after you guys and did a magnificent job of it. I mean, if there was a baggy green that got handed out to the players' wives for success in their stories, Mum would have 10 of them because she's a great mum. She's a great wife, great mum, and just a beautiful person to share your life with. And she's created three other beautiful little lives as well, which equally, you know, who would have thought that you and I would be broadcasting together? It's crazy.
It's so cool.
And it's cool, yeah. Yeah, it's cool and it's again, it's things that you need to feed relationships as well and never grow tired, you know. That's the important challenge for all of us as people, not to take people for granted. And you often do take people for granted when they're the closest to you. And it's important to always remind yourselves that, gee, I'm not going to do that because that person really needs me right now, or you know, could do with a bit of a hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very special, Grace. Our entire lives are lives that have been so full. I feel like I've got zero regrets on any of it. It's so cool.
Yeah, absolutely, and even cooler that we get to do it together now as well. Share the microphone. It's always nice when I get to turn over and go, "And Dab, what do you think?" That was awesome during the World Cup. Working with ICC together, it's just that feeling definitely never gets old.
And long may it continue as well, because sport does give so much to people, you know, and voicing sport is a very intimate part of the experience that people have, because not everyone can afford to go, you know, to an event, or even the desire to go to an event even, you know. So to be able to listen to it, to see it, to be a part of it, participation in sport is really what it's about, because regardless of what you choose, when you're interested in sport, chances are you're interested in your health and your well-being. And as a number one priority in life, you can have all the money in the world, but if you haven't got your health, then what have you got? Mental and physical health. So, you know, sport allows you to engage in both mental and physical if you so choose. And it's important what you do. And it's respected what you do as well.
What a player, what a journey, what a story. We're going to take a quick break and have a bit of fun on the other end. All right, well, we've had enough about talking, but I mean, let's just finish our podcast with a little bit of fun. I'm going to rapid fire some questions at you. This segment's called Like Father, Like Daughter. So you're just going to answer open and honestly, and I'll just give you a few and then we can wrap up the podcast.
Okay.
All righty, let's do it. Okay, who handles pressure better, you or me?
I do. Do I need to give an explanation?
You can. Yep. Give a little explanation if you want to. I definitely don't. I'll either react, you know, up here or down here. There's no in between.
Yeah. I think we've got very similar personalities. Other than, I guess I've just learnt over time to understand pressure, and pressure is kind of, it's almost my best friend, because generally, I'm a very laid-back person, so I need the pressure to be able to agitate me to a state where I'm wanting to perform in whatever it is, you know, sport or broadcasting or coaching. I kind of need them. I need that kind of prod, and I reckon you're a bit the same as well. Generally, very laid-back person.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, who would survive longer on an island? You win again. We actually had this conversation around the dinner table, and we were all like, who would survive, you know, the longest?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you got.
I would not be first voted out. I would be a dark horse. Walked out me, I would be a dark horse 100%.
Yeah. I don't know. I think Tommy.
What, Tommy, you'd vote me off first. Out of the whole family, you'd vote me off first.
You're probably an extra mouth to feed, yeah. I reckon you're gone.
No, Mum would for sure be off first.
No,
100%.
No.
I would be.
Mate, if this went to a tribal council right now, you'd be gone. Huh? You and your pearly white teeth can munch away on something else, because you're not feeding on our fish. You're out.
That is dog ass. That is so dog. I think Tom would probably take it out. My youngest brother, your youngest child, I think he's lazy as anything, but he knows how to play chess. He knows how to get what he wants. Mm. He'd sidle up to Josh, the middle boy, who'd like work it all out, and then at the last second, ax him off. That'd 100% be what would happen.
He's conniving. Oh, yeah, maybe.
So.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
All right. Who has a worse temper?
Oh, you've definitely got a worse temper. But
no way!
It has to be categorized, this, right? So, for example, I will admit anything technical.
Like,
for example, if you have to fill out an online arrival card, arrival card, I will go from naught to 1 billion in about 1 second, because that stuff it's the minutiae that really does my head in. Anything that's got like, you know how much I love to cook, but
yeah,
desserts, you're a scientist. You're not a cook. You're just a scientist. You follow a recipe, you got a temperature, and it comes out perfect. Ripper. I don't like that. I like this sort of this, that,
imperfection.
You know, just I'm freestyle. So
yeah.
You've changed. You used to be a very placid individual, but now you're like proper angry ant.
No, I'm not. I am not. I am cool as a cucumber.
Hell no. Hell no.
Yeah.
Hell no. To the no.
Hell huh? to the no. I'm definitely not. No.
You changed. Just admit you've changed.
Small things irritate me. Like, this stuff irritates me. When you don't agree with me, that irritates me.
Yeah, but that's all right. That's everyone's allowed to have a different opinion.
Anyway, before you say something else, let's move on. I'm not going to say who overthinks more in big moments, because that's definitely me. Who's the bigger diva?
These questions are just, they're so loaded. Like,
and you are, it is you.
How am I a diva?
Oh, okay, you're not. I've experienced a lot of divas in my time as a 20, what am I, 24 this year. You are not in comparison to some, but you can pull the diva card like no other.
Really? What's an example of that?
100% you can. No, I'm not going to give an example, but I'm just going to blanket it and you can. But I can too.
Seriously, you got to get a new producer. These questions are just, they're making you look so bad.
What do you mean? No, I'm talking about in a family dynamic, not in anything else. And this isn't a family dynamic. We're just talking about family dynamic, not in workplace, not in anything life-based. This is just family dynamic.
Okay, I'll give you an example, right? You get in the car, and the fuel is empty. Like, that's the moment where I can be a diva.
That's annoying.
Like, what part of the car's on it? So now you're like winging in a prayer to the nearest petrol station.
Like, but some reason I get the blame when that happens, and it's not even me half the time. I'm not even in Brisbane for the last 2 months, and I get, well, Grace, it's your car. I'm like, goddamn, I haven't even been here. How's it my fault? That's Diva.
See, you saw it right there, folks. Live Diva action right there. That is 101 revealing.
Nah. Okay, well, I feel like I'm getting exposed, so this segment could be... This should be over.
It should be over.
This should be over. This episode's done. All right, Dad. Well, thank you for joining. Enjoy India.
Yeah, I will.
Enjoy India. Yep. Enjoy coaching.
Go GT. Huh? Bang.
Go GT.
Let's get on a roll.
Yep. Keep on the winning streak, would you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll try our best. Right. Don't worry.
Love you lots. Thanks for joining.
Ciao. Yep, thank you.
Well, Dad, thank you again so much for joining the episode. It's always so nice to have a chat to you, but it was great to bring you on to Game On with Grace. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the episode. I hope you loved this conversation as much as I did. Make sure you hit the follow button or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Share the episode with a friend, because we've got so many more legendary guests coming on, hilarious debates, big stories coming your way. So stay tuned. I'm Grace Hayden. Until next time, keep competitive.